Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens to psychiatric patients whose illnesses defy easy diagnosis and lasting relief? And how do their doctors learn to provide care and comfort when they can't offer a true cure? In her ongoing work as an inpatient psychiatrist, Dr. Christine Montross regularly sees patients at some of the darkest moments in their lives, tortured by their own malfunctioning minds and desperate for help. And as Montross will tell us, while even the most conscientious care does not guarantee that every patient will recover fully, they continue to need compassion and advocacy from their caregivers. Montross is assistant professor of psychiatry and human behavior and co-director of the Medical Humanities and Bioethics Scholarly Concentration at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University. Her new book is called Falling into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. Christine, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Chris.
You write very close to the opening of this book that you had more faith in medicine before you became a doctor. What do you mean by that?
I think all of us, as non-practitioners, which I was before I undertook medical school, really believe and want to believe that medicine has clear-cut answers for the illnesses which afflict all of us. And when I began my medical training, I think I started to realize that those answers all too often elude us. So this faith that I had that doctors know exactly how to proceed and illnesses respond as we expect them to really began to morph into a deeper understanding that we're still learning a lot about the body and the mind, and often illnesses don't behave in exactly the way we'd hope they might.
That's interesting, and I think a lot of patients have been there when you come back from the doctor for treatment of any kind of illness and you're sort of shocked and outraged that you're told, we don't know.
I think that's exactly right, and I was just talking with a colleague this morning who was describing how he had sought care for a medical condition at a number of the top institutions in the country, and that he was speaking with experts, and their recommended courses of treatment and action diverged one from the other. And we were talking about how still in this age where we feel as though we've made these great strides and advances in medicine, we still have conflicting opinions even amongst the brightest scholars in our field.
So that leaves you, Christine, to balance your intellectual understanding that some patients simply will not respond to the treatments that have been designed to help them with the emotional sense that you really want to make them better.
Of course, and I think that's true for all healers and doctors. We hope for our patient. We get into the profession of medicine in the hopes that we can provide relief and cure for the suffering that our patients endure, whether that's medical suffering or psychic suffering. And it's frustrating and difficult at times as a care provider to not be able to provide relief when patients are dealing with such terribly difficult symptoms.
So if I go to an orthopedist and I say my elbow hurts when I do this, I mean, it may not be a simple, straightforward diagnosis, but I can describe what I'm feeling. That's often not the case with your patients. They may be unwilling or unable to really convey to you what they're experiencing.
I think that's true. You know, a friend of mine once, who was a pediatrician, once said that being a pediatrician is sometimes like a veterinarian, that your patients aren't always able to articulate their complaints to you. Mm-hmm. And psychiatry is like that in some ways also, in that our patients' circumstances may be obfuscated by a range of different things. They may not want to be completely forthcoming with us. Perhaps they are deeply paranoid and aren't sure at all whether we can be trusted. Perhaps they're terribly depressed and suicidal, and they have an earnest plan to end their lives, and they feel if they disclose this plan that we might interfere. Sometimes the patients are on street drugs or drinking too much alcohol and using prescription drugs in a way that is not beneficial to them, and that may be clouding the way that they're able to describe our symptoms to us, or they might be wanting to hide those habits as well. So our job is both to create an alliance with our patients so that they do trust us, but also to work with them so that we're both working toward the same goal in their care.
So what kind of information do you use beside sort of the content of what patients say or don't say to you in order to assess their condition?
Well, there are a number of different things, and I think many of them are the things that any of us use when we're talking to people and we try to ascertain how trustworthy a patient is in talking with us. But certainly there are some signs of mental illness that can present themselves in a nonverbal way. So sometimes I might see a patient who has not been bathing because they fear that the water supply is poisoned or tainted, and they'll come in, quite disheveled in clothes that are soiled. Sometimes patients who are manic are wearing 20 different rings on their fingers and have their hair done in outrageous and outlandish fashions. You know, there are sometimes visual cues mm-hmm. to the symptoms that a patient might be enduring. But I think also, you know, for the more subtle cases, it's not unlike when you see a friend and you can tell by interacting with them that they're more down than usual. So if I'm seeing a patient who is depressed, we all know to some degree what depression looks like. You know, people move more slowly, they talk more slowly. They're going to be complaining of not sleeping well and perhaps not eating well. They're going to be talking in a way that sometimes is hopeless and helpless. And so those are things that many people would be able to recognize. And I think anxiety is similar. When you see someone who's really, really anxious, you're able to identify that even as a layperson.
I was interested that of all the, you know, diagnostic tools that you have available to you, some of the easiest things to determine are when patients are fabricating their own symptoms.
So there are a set of tools that doctors have developed over the years to try to determine if patients are, the term we use is malingering. Mm-hmm. These are patients who are inventing symptoms for some type of gain. This is not a large number of symptoms, but we can all imagine the circumstances under which they might present themselves. So someone who is feigning disability in order to receive disability benefits, someone who is trying to exempt themselves from a military obligation, someone who is seeking pain medication to fuel an addiction rather than physical pain. So there are a number of different situations where people might be apt to tell untruths to a doctor in order to obtain something that they want to obtain. And so neurologists, physicians of all kinds have developed various tools to try to ascertain truth and to tease out truth from fiction in these situations.
How much time in a hospital setting is typically available to your sickest patients?
You know, it really depends from one patient to the next. Certainly, we treat patients until they are no longer in acute danger, and that may be 24 or 48 hours for some. It may be several weeks for others. The average length of stay is around 5 to 7 days for a patient these days in an acute inpatient setting. And, you know, historically, patients might have stayed months or even years in a psychiatric hospital. We really don't see that any longer. Admissions to psychiatric units today are largely for patients who are a risk to themselves or to other people and who demonstrate that that's an imminent risk. So people really are not hospitalized unless they're in a true state of emergency. And in a similar way, people are really discharged as soon as that acute and imminent risk has passed.
Is that only about money? I mean, if you and your colleagues had your way and money were not an object, would many of your patients stay longer?
Many would, and some would not. Mm-hmm. I think there are certainly patients for whom hospitalization is not the most therapeutic treatment modality. There are patients for whom outpatient treatment and the structure of their daily lives is actually far more helpful than being hospitalized. But there's no question that there's a kind of attention that patients can receive and a really heightened level of observation that patients can receive when they are hospitalized. So definitely there are times when we always act first in the patient's clinical benefit. So we're not going to be making treatment decisions based on what the insurance companies say or based on what the money is. But certainly there are times when we start to recognize that the financial pressures that are going to be incurred by the patient are going to be so great if we keep them in the hospital longer that that starts to become a part of the treatment equation. So definitely there are pressures where we must discharge patients when we think there could be a great deal of benefit to having them hospitalized for a longer period of time.
Do you think some of those financial pressures are because there's not, I mean, you sort of can't guarantee that people are going to get better in the same way that you know, if you were going to operate on someone's knee, you could say, look, if I offer this procedure, it'll take this long, it'll cost this much, and then my patient will walk unimpeded.
Well, psychiatric cure is certainly more ambiguous than surgical cure. I think we're not removing something that's inflamed or infected, or we're not making of something that can be visibly seen repaired. That being said, we absolutely have results that are easily demonstrated, and we can watch patients as they stop being paranoid, as their hallucinations quiet, as their depression remits. So I think we do absolutely see patients improve in those visible and remarkable ways. That being said, I think I think sometimes it's harder for outsiders to see, because it's not the same as a surgical cure.
You write with, I think, really admirable compassion about a particularly difficult patient named Lauren, who is a sort of frequent flyer at your hospital.
Yes. Her
tendency towards self-harm was alarming, to say the least.
So this is a young woman who had been, when I saw her, had been hospitalized 23 times in the 4 years prior to that admission, all for ingesting dangerous objects. So she had swallowed, when I saw her, she had just crushed and swallowed light bulbs, but she had also in the past swallowed knives and scissors and bed springs and barbecue skewers, and really something that's very difficult, I think, to understand. But this was a pattern that she was in, where she would swallow these things in moments of distress. So when she learned that her sister had hepatitis, or after she had an argument with a neighbor, or after she learned that her uncle was terminally ill, she would swallow these dangerous objects. She was not psychotic. She was in touch with reality. But she would then bring herself to the emergency room so that the objects could be removed before they had catastrophic results, before they perforated some portion of her gut. So it's very hard to understand, when you hear about something like that, how someone would inflict harm upon themselves and then seek care to prevent that harm from happening. But indeed, that's what Lauren had done.
Hmm. And at the same time, you know, you go in and the other staff members go in and truly want to help her. And she was incredibly truculent, just difficult to be around, abusive. She would, you know, call you names. What does it take to keep your cool when somebody seems to be trying to push you away?
I think the key to keeping one's cool is really understanding where that's coming from. And I think the way that I came to understand Lauren was that she was a young woman who obviously had very, very limited coping mechanisms. She did not know how to handle distress other than in this highly maladaptive way. And the more that I came to know her, the more I came to understand that she had had this deeply traumatic past in which she had been abandoned and violated in many ways. And so I think that the way that she engaged with me and with others, which was in this very aggressive stance, was partially a means of self-protection, that she wanted to reject us before we rejected her, that she, on the one hand, came to us for care and treatment, but because she hadn't had reliable people who had cared for her and treated her wounds when she was small, I think she was in a very defensive stance against us, and so didn't really know how to engage with the very people that were trying to provide her with healing and care.
Dr. Christine Montross is my guest. She's assistant professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University and a practicing inpatient psychiatrist. Her new book is called Falling into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. You can be part of this conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Christine Montross. She is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Human Behavior at the medical school, the Warren Albert Medical School of Brown University. Her new book is called Falling into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Christine, you also share little bits about your personal life, and I'm really curious about what it takes for you to go home and be a good partner to your wife, a good mother to your children, when you've had a day that you know will keep you up for the rest of that night.
Well, Chris, I think a good portion of our psychiatric training is how to enact exactly this sort of balance. I think that as practitioners of psychiatry, we are constantly in the midst of great suffering. And it's very important for us to be able to maintain a respectful distance from that. While we engage in a very present way with our patients' suffering, we also need to find a way to detach from that enough when we leave them so that we aren't brought down by it entirely. And, you know, one of the things I write about in the book is something that a dear friend and mentor of mine said to me, who said, when you are a psychologist or a psychiatrist, when you're a psychotherapist, you're really working with people who have fallen through the ice into a cold lake. Mm. And you are going to go out there on that thin ice to try to pull them in, but you have to have an anchor to the shore so that you don't fall in as well. And that's always struck me as a really beautiful metaphor for the willingness of psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers to really join our patients in the danger that they face, to try to help them regain their footing in the chaos of their lives, but also maintaining a very necessary anchor in the parts of our own lives that are stabilizing. So in writing about my family and my children, I think for me it was an important counterpoint to say not only do I have these anchors and on the shore of my lake, but also I think dealing with the patients that I work with just gives me an intense gratitude for the moments in which my family is healthy and happy.
It is, you know, when you talk about going out there on the ice to sort of reach a hand out to your patients, I really love that metaphor. And it's interesting because so many times people who are profoundly mentally ill, they have people who love them or they once did who have just, you know, sort of run out of steam, run out of energy, run out of ways to cope with these illnesses that have changed the nature of their relationships with their loved ones. It sort of takes a lot, doesn't it, just to still want to be there. Like the rest of the world is inclined to run away from these people even though they are at the lowest moments of their lives.
It absolutely does. And we frequently see family members who have just given so much, invested so many resources, so much energy in the plights of the people that they love. And it's really a very humbling experience to see that, and you also have a lot of sympathy for what families go through. I think that said, one of the reasons that I chose to write about some of these cases is I think that sometimes we as a culture respond to severe mental illness with a degree of stigma and repugnance, that we want to hold these people at arm's length. We want to look at them and say, that person is not like me. That person is not like my family members. I'm going to set them over here on the side while I engage on the other side of the room. And I think my true aim in the book was to write about some of these most serious plights that might strike us as really alarming. Someone who swallows bed springs. I write about a woman who has thoughts of killing her child. You know, these are things that we tend to think of as inhuman responses to the world. But my hope in writing about them was to lend a humanity to them so that readers would begin to understand these are people just like the rest of us, that we all have this capacity in our mind for health. And sometimes there are times when all of us lose balance in our psyche to varying degrees, and that affliction can strike any of us at any time. So I think that isolation that patients and their families feel is very, very real.
So the woman you just alluded to, that's the patient you call Nancy, is that right?
Anna, excuse me.
Yeah, yeah. And you really, she was afraid that she would carry these things out, and yet she couldn't get these ideas out of her head. And at this point, figuring out exactly what is driving those thoughts is really important, because the right diagnosis, or I should say the wrong diagnosis, could lead to a treatment that makes everything worse.
That's absolutely right, Chris. So this is a patient who had a young son, 15-month-old son. She came to the emergency room because she was repeatedly having thoughts of killing her son. She loved her son very much, but she was just haunted by these thoughts. So this was a perfect example of how the right diagnosis can make a world of difference in someone's treatment and also the outcome of the situation. As I got to know her, I really had to begin to ascertain, were these command hallucinations? Was she having psychotic symptoms like we know that Andrea Yates had when she drowned her children in Texas? Was she having those kinds of symptoms that were really putting her at grave risk of harming her son? Or were these anxious, obsessive thoughts where she feared so much that she might hurt her son that she kept seeing it played out over and over in her mind that she would do this horrible thing and that it would have these terrible consequences? So my job was really to try to begin to understand which of those symptoms, which of those diagnoses and symptoms were more accurate. Because as you say, the treatments of those two were absolutely polar opposites, that if she were having command hallucinations, the treatment for that would really involve keeping her away from her son, that in those moments, just like Andrea Yates, she might be at real risk of harming her child. However, if she were having these anxious, obsessive thoughts, the treatment for those symptoms would actually be for her to spend more time around her son, for her even to be alone with her son, to realize she's a good mother, she's a capable mother, she's not going to act on those fears, and that she would begin to be reassured by the fact that she was able to be with him and not harm him. So it's an incredibly delicate position for a clinician to be in, because you really must have some degree of certainty about your own diagnostic capacity, because if, you know, the wrong diagnosis could have catastrophic implications for your patient and, in this case, her child.
That particular case study made me think a lot about where the line exists between sort of somewhat normal thinking and you know, the stress of being a new parent and illness or really, you know, slightly quirky behavior or odd behavior and true mental illness. And you share in the book, and I think a lot of parents can relate to this, holding your new baby. You were on a boat. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, so I was holding my infant daughter in a boat at this beloved lake in Michigan where I had been going to since I was a child and my family had gone to before that. And my parents were taking us out for a boat ride in this gorgeous lake, and I knew that I was holding her tightly, that my parents were there, that my partner was there, should something unseen, unforeseen happen and our baby fall, we would all jump in and save her. We're all capable swimmers. We would all act in that way. But just the fear that struck me in the moment of looking over the edge of the little boat, that if I dropped her, she could sink and be gone. Mm-hmm. And that I actually had this flash of a fear that then I might drop her, even though I knew that I was holding her so tightly that I would never do that. And that moment made me realize if I felt afraid and had to kind of back away from the edge of the boat in that moment, that maybe this was some glimmer of what Anna was feeling and was unable to let go of, and so just festered in her anxious state over and over again, so she could not let go of that thought, and the fears just grew and grew for her.
Hmm. How important is it for you, for the sake of your patients, to sort of trace back to any trauma in their lives and any biochemical or genetic vulnerabilities and the intersection at which those things come together to create what is, I don't know if you would call it a cycle of true mental illness?
You know, that really depends on the patient and the illness, I think, Chris. There are certainly illnesses which have very clear genetic risk factors. If a family member has bipolar illness, then the patient might be more apt to be having a bipolar depression rather than a major depression. But that being said, and certainly trauma can cause certain illnesses, post-traumatic stress disorder, obviously. It can exacerbate mental illness. It can make people more vulnerable to mental illness. But in almost every case, these are multifactorial presentations. The patients who we see come in with some combination of a genetic predisposition, stressful psychosocial situations, and also just the mood complaints that they're having at the time. So it's very important in that we take all of those things into account, but it's really impossible to say something very general about, you know, all of our patients have a trauma history. That's certainly not true. And as we all know also, there are people who endure great traumas who don't suffer from mental illness. So there aren't links that are as easy or as clear as we'd like them sometimes to be.
What strategies do you use to help a patient who may, you know, documentably have a problem? They've been brought in by loved ones. They are not acting in a way that is sort of appropriate for the environment that they're in. But they themselves are experiencing what feels like euphoria. They feel good. They don't want to change what's going on with their minds.
I write about a patient like this in Falling Into the Fire. There was a young man who I saw who really felt as though he was undergoing a kind of spiritual rebirth. He was following a figure named Alma, the hugging saint, who at the time I actually did not know was a real figure, but she is in fact a very revered Indian spiritual figure who travels around the world giving hugs to people as a form of consolation for their suffering. He was following her through the American West on kind of a pilgrimage, and when he returned home, he began engaging in some bizarre behaviors that really worried his family. He wasn't eating and drinking. He wasn't sleeping much. He started walking backwards. He really was not and wasn't able to describe these things as anything other than kind of a spiritual awakening. So in those moments, I think as psychiatrists, we're at a real point where we must decide, is this a divine experience or a euphoric experience that someone is having, or is this something that potentially is the beginnings of an illness? And these kinds of symptoms have been written about a great deal in the past, but, you know, we start to think about, gosh, if Joan of Arc presented today to the emergency room with her thoughts of saying she heard the voice of God and wanted to overthrow the British government, I'm pretty sure that we'd admit her to the hospital. So we don't want to medicate divinity. We don't want to squash out eccentricity. On the other hand, what we know now that we've come to understand the mind more and more clearly is that oftentimes a kind of grandiosity, a feeling of greater connectedness to the universe. This particular young man was feeling love emanating from inanimate objects, from filing cabinets around him. He believed he was communicating with inanimate objects. That we really began to understand that these were symptoms that were pathological. And so then the task begins to try to work with that patient so that they join you in viewing it in a way that's going to veer them and steer them toward mental health over the course of the treatment.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Mags in Coppell. Hi, Mags.
Hi. Yes, my question is basically, I had a psychotic episode here in June, and I left my office and went to a church, and because I couldn't make it home, but I felt that was a safe place, and I experienced a psychotic episode there. And I'm just wondering, is there any type of education for our churches and our police force? I was handcuffed, both my arms and legs, and I was taken out of the church. And I was still in a psychotic episode where then once the ambulance came, they shot me up with some medication, and I was coming back to myself, but I could still hear the police officers making fun of me. And I'm wondering if there's any type of education for them. Or hang up.
Thanks for your call, Max.
You know, I want to preface first by saying I obviously can't speak to specific symptoms and illnesses that people are struggling with, but just from hearing that, I think so often people who have what can often be a terrifying experience, that they have an onset of symptoms where they are feeling out of touch with reality or not in control of their mind. It can be so, so terrifying. And having an interaction where people respond in a way that is the antithesis of calming and reassuring can really heighten the scariness of a moment like an episode like the caller describes. You know, one of the reasons I wrote this book, again, is to try to bring awareness to some of these issues and a humanity to them. I think also there's plenty of literature out there that speaks to this experience. I think of the beautiful book by Ellen Sachs called The Center Cannot Hold. This is a schizophrenic law professor in California, just a brilliant woman, who writes so searingly about the experience of being restrained in a psychiatric hospital, which fortunately happens less and less. But I think the caller speaks to an ability to really retain a lucidity and understanding of what's going on, even in the midst of a kind of break with reality. And certainly Professor Sachs writes about that also. And I think we forget sometimes that patients, even when they're not really able to engage with us in a way that seems lucid and normal, are often scared and at least are able to engage with what's going on around them in terms of hearing it and understanding it. And so I can only say to that caller that I can imagine how scary that was, and I think we're increasing understanding and visibility about that, but probably not at a fast enough pace.
It can also obviously be jarring for someone who is in possession of his or her faculties to see someone in the throes of a psychotic break. Do you think, though, that the general public is sort of too afraid that people with severe mental illness are also dangerous?
I think there are two things at play. First of all, I think that as a culture, we overestimate the dangerousness of the mentally ill, mm-hmm. that the cases that get the most publicity are the cases that do have violent outcomes, when in reality, that's a very, very small percentage of the people who suffer from mental illness. I also think that there's something that makes us all feel vulnerable when we see someone who is in an episode like that, that we become kind of afraid for our own stability and sanity. And I think that makes people, again, want to distance themselves and separate from that. And, you know, I write a little bit in the book about how even clinicians can have a moment where they, going back to Lauren, the patient who swallowed the dangerous objects, even some of her doctors would make jokes, the opening section that I write about, the gastroenterology fellow called me and said, you know what she really needs? And I said, no. And he said, she really needs a zipper.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Dr. Christine Montross, author of the new book, Falling Into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Christine Montross. Her new book is called Falling Into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. And before the break, Christine, you were talking about another doctor sort of joking that your patient Lauren, who had to have multiple surgeries to remove dangerous objects from her abdomen, that doctor said what she really needed to fix her was a zipper.
That's right. And I think that's an example of how physicians are not immune from making these insensitive comments and from our own frustrations beginning to take over and how we approach and care for the people who come to us seeking help. So I think, the caller just made mention of kind of increasing awareness about the sensitivity and the precariousness of the position that people are in when they seek mental health treatment. And I think you can never be too frequently reminded of that.
You write fascinatingly on the subject of patients who come to believe, based on a skewed perception of their own bodies, that a certain appendage, an arm, a leg, a hand is foreign to them, and they will present to doctors just begging to have this thing removed that they feel like is not part of their bodies. And you are sort of left with this conundrum about which takes precedence, the wholeness, the physiological wholeness of their bodies, or the wellness of their minds.
That's right. So this is a very small number of people that we know of in the world. This isn't a really well-known or well-understood phenomenon, but it's come to be named body integrity identity disorder. And these are people who really have a very clear sense that they were meant to be amputees. Such a strange idea to hear about, but when you see people interviewed or talk with these patients or read quotes from them, they describe with real precision a sense, you know, a woman might say, my body ends right here, and she may gesture and draw a line across the middle of her thighs. Hmm. There are people who believe they really are meant to have a full left leg, but their right leg should end just below the knee. This is really a physical sensation that they have, that their right arm is not part of them, or the left foot is not a part of their bodies that they feel should be there, should belong. And what's tragic about patients who suffer from this disorder, which I should say is not even included in the DSM at this point, so it's very poorly understood, but these are patients who sometimes take very, very drastic measures to try to make their bodies realize the form that they really believe they should have. So these are patients who sometimes do very dramatic things, tie themselves to train tracks, use shotguns to blow off limbs. I mean, really gruesome things to try to have themselves become amputees like they believe they should be. There even is a surgeon who in the UK performed surgical amputations for a small number of these patients, believing that it was far better for them to have a clean, sterile surgical procedure rather than to undergo these dramatic and potentially incredibly dangerous self-amputations that were taking place. But you know, I think. But his hospital eventually banned him from continuing to do it, even though he described them as some of the most rewarding surgeries he'd ever done. Because paradoxically, what these people recount over and over again is that after the amputations, they feel more whole. Hmm. So these are symptoms that, by and large, evaporate after an amputation takes place, where the people have reported this huge degree of distress, but then that distress dissolves once their body takes the form that they believe it always should have had.
Yeah, it's such a question because, you know, for most of us, we can't conceive of wanting to be without a functioning limb. And yet, who are we to make that decision for someone else?
I think it's such a compelling ethical question. You know, as doctors, we vow to first do no harm. And there's nothing that seems like harm much more than cutting off a perfectly good and functional, healthy limb. On the other hand, you know, there are arguments by people who say we allow patients to undergo all kinds of different surgical procedures that do no good and, in fact, do harm. You know, you can inject fat into different parts of your body. You can have your breasts made to a gargantuan size. You can split your tongue down the middle or have horns implanted in your head. You can have all kinds of tattoos that, you know, go all over your body. You can pierce any body part you want. None of these things increase functionality or are important for people's health, and yet we allow people to do these things to their bodies because we believe, in a sense, that our bodies belong to us. So I think this question of this continuum is, should we then allow people to, if they want to, just like they might want to split their tongue in two, should we allow them to take off an arm? But it's ethically so complicated. I think, you know, what I return to over and over again, on the one hand, it's the only means we have of easing suffering in the people who suffer from this condition. On the other hand, it feels so much like this is a neurologic or psychiatric disorder. So to have a surgical, quote-unquote, cure for something where the problem really resides in the brain also seems misguided. So I think it's a really fascinating question about some of the ethical conundrums that emerge in psychiatric practice.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also join us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Raza in Bedford. Hi, Raza.
How are you doing? I was just a very interesting conversation. The cases that you guys are going over are pretty extreme. My question was very simple. You know, people who have who have issues with chronic procrastination, stuff like that, what's the tie into the actual neurochemical part of, you know, part of the brain? And, you know, because they can go into pretty self-destructive cycles. And just wanted to know if there's any cure, medical or therapeutic. I'll take my answer over here.
Thanks for your call. I'm not sure if that's something you've looked at all in your clinical practice, Christine.
You know, I think, Raza, I can speak to the fact that, you know, you mentioned that these are extreme cases, and absolutely the cases that I wrote about in Falling Into the Fire were those that really seemed to me to be the most kind of mysterious, the ones that kept me up at night, that I really struggled to make sense of. I think if I understand your question correctly, you're trying to get at some of the origins and the treatments for issues like procrastination and some other symptoms along those lines. And certainly, you know, though I don't write about them in my book, there are all kinds of things that just interfere with our daily lives, whether they're mood symptoms or anxiety symptoms or just kind of performance traits like procrastination that can be helped and often helped a great deal by psychotherapy. And sometimes medications can be helpful for people with attentional deficits and those kinds of things. So there are lots of much, much more kind of simple and straightforward things that bother people in their daily lives that can be helped with psychotherapy. And sometimes medications can be helpful in those instances too, just obviously depending on the precise symptoms that someone's dealing with.
You write about the fact that for people who are suffering from really profound, serious mental illnesses, clearly the compassion and the comfort that they can receive is vastly better than it was a century or more ago. But in terms of sort of guaranteeing them that we can get them back to health, we haven't made as much progress in mental health as we have in other fields of medicine.
Yes, I think, you know, when looking back historically, psychiatry has a particularly inglorious past. Looking at some of the treatments that, and I use the term treatments very, very loosely here, some of the treatments that the old asylums used to provide, many are really quite barbaric. I mean, I write about how people were strapped into chairs and spun at huge speeds, inducing nausea, obviously, when they spun around and around. And this would really calm and quiet the psychotic patients. And the doctors were thrilled by how calm the patients would become, when, in fact, they were just making them feel awful. But this was only one of many, many kind of barbaric treatments in the past. People were submerged underwater. Ovaries were routinely removed in hysteric young women. So psychiatry has come a very, very long way from some of the things that we used to do to the mentally ill. That being said, there have been advances in certain fields of medicine where we can really look at, you know, eradication of certain infectious diseases, very good medications to prevent high blood pressure, and we really understand the mechanisms of diabetes and are able to target medications appropriately for our diabetic patients. But mental illness remains somewhat mysterious. Now, that's not to say that we don't have medications that work or that our medications are really in their infancy, because that's not the case. We certainly have medications that work and work very well. But we haven't seen, for example, a psychiatric illness that has been eradicated. We haven't been able to wipe schizophrenia off the map in the way that some other illnesses have been really tamed by the medical community.
I have obviously only a layperson's understanding of this, but have we made progress in understanding why so many severe mental illnesses seem to present for the first time in late adolescence or early adulthood?
You know, I don't think we understand why that is. And interestingly, some of those same mental illnesses, like bipolar illness, which you might see and with a peak around ages 18 to 24, there also will then be another peak in the late 50s and early 60s of life. So sometimes there are these bimodal peaks where there are two different periods of life that seem to be particularly vulnerable to illness. I don't think we have a clear understanding of that.
What do you think in terms of, like, how often are you able to see a patient in really a crisis situation in the hospital and then know how that patient has done afterwards?
Well, a lot of these patients I see over and over again, and this is one of the real, I think, tragedies of mental health care in America. And I actually just wrote a piece in the New York Times Sunday Review this last week about how so many of our patients, you know, they come into the hospital, we get them stabilized. You know, someone, for example, who might be hearing voices and seeing visions, and maybe that person has gone off of their medication or not had access to their medication. They come into the hospital, we're able to reduce their symptoms, get them back to a level of functioning. But too often when we discharge them, the level of outpatient care that a patient like that requires is just not available. That person would really need weekly appointments with a therapist, potentially monthly appointments with a psychiatrist, a kind of close level of treatment to make sure that they have access to their medications and that they're taking them. But all too often, these patients are discharged. They can't afford their medicines, or they lose track of their appointments, or appointments just simply aren't available for months out. And then the patients come back over and over again to the hospital where they seek care. And we can provide that stabilizing acute care, but you know, it's not a desirable cycle in which patients go from crisis to wellness to crisis to wellness to crisis to wellness. What would really be better is to stabilize these patients and have them maintain that stability. But unfortunately, I often see how patients do longitudinally, and often it has a very cyclical pattern.
Have your definitions of things like hope and optimism changed over the years that you've been a practicing psychiatrist?
I don't know that they've changed. I think one of the aspects of psychiatric practice that I treasure is that the ability of the human spirit to really endure is vast. And I am often, even though I feel like I'm often in the midst of great suffering and tragedy, I'm just as often in the midst of people who are able to overcome illness and to sort of claim back their lives in the midst of great challenges in a way that can actually be quite inspiring. So I think someone could look at psychiatric practice in an acute inpatient setting and say, gosh, that must be so disheartening, that must be so depressing. And certainly there are moments of real brokenheartedness in it. You know, you may make mention of adolescents who have symptoms. You know, when I see an 18 or 20-year-old having a first psychotic break, it's devastating for the patient. It's devastating for the family. It's devastating for me to see that occur. On the other hand, I've also seen some of the most remarkable strengths from my patients that I think I wouldn't have had access to were I not in the midst of their struggles.
Dr. Christine Montross is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Human Behavior and Co-Director of the Medical Humanities and Bioethics Scholarly Concentration at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University. Her new book is called Falling into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. Christine, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for giving us this hour.
What a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And of course, we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.